We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, my name is Toni Spencer. I'm an alcoholic. It's so good to be here today. I enjoy saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous and being of service at every opportunity. I have so much to be grateful for that I love the opportunity to give back to the thing that saved my life. So I want to thank Tara for putting this together and, you know, for the way that you serve. And I believe it's helping and reaching a lot of people. Yeah, so I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad is an alcoholic, and what we say in Spanish is a marihuano, which means he smokes weed every day. And we hope that he has weed, because if he's just drinking, you know, it might be good for 6 to 12 beers, but if it goes beyond that, and if he gets his hands on liquor, it's definitely going to be a bad night. It's going to be a lot of fighting. You know, cops are going to get called. My mom's likely going to get beat up. And from the first memory I have, the alcoholic life was the only normal one. I come from a long line of alcoholics, drug addicts, and untreated Al-Anons. So life as a kid was very chaotic. My dad couldn't keep a job, and we could never keep an apartment. I'm the youngest of three girls. I have two older sisters, Denise Marie and Diana Rochelle. And my first resentment in life was that they had pretty names. And I got stuck with the name Antonia Leonor, which I was named after both my grandmothers. Today, I'm grateful that I have that name. And I'm proud of that name. And of course, I go by Toni for short. But I just saw the differences. Even though the alcoholic life was the only normal one for me, like I mentioned, I'd go to school and I would see kids that had a really good backpack, looking like they had a good life. And I always felt separate, apart from. I always felt like I was stupid. And there was problems for me in school. Kindergarten was great. First grade was hard. My middle sister, Diane, had to get called down from the fifth grade to where I was at in the first grade. And because I wouldn't get my head off of the desk, I just could not do my life even then. And they'd bring my sister down and she would rub my back. And she would say, "It's going to be okay, Tone. You just got to make it till recess. And then a little bit after recess, we'll have lunch and I'll meet you at lunch. Okay. I'll meet you by the tetherball." And I just couldn't do life. I just couldn't. There was a lot of chaos in the house. My dad, if you didn't catch him on payday, he was likely going to drink his paycheck. And my mom was a lady who just did the best that she could. You know, she worked. My parents always had these pretty big fights. And there was a lot of unmanageability. There was times in my childhood where my parents couldn't really get it together. And so my grandmother, my dad's mom, would come in and ask to take care of me and my sisters. And my sisters never wanted to go. But there was 3 years during my childhood that I lived with my grandmother. And living with grandma was great. She was really strict, but she gave me structure, and I had the best grades when I lived with my grandma. There was a lot of accountability. I loved the one-on-one attention I got with her, but I also very early on learned how to manipulate. Because my grandma was strict, I would be with her for about a year, and then I'd go back with my parents, and I would tell them how hard it was living with grandma and how mean she was. She wasn't really mean. She was just really strict. And then my family would dote like all this love on me, my mom and my sisters and my dad. And then I'd come back to live with grandma. And then I would tell her like the unmanageability. I didn't get fed and I didn't get this. And I went to school with holes in my clothes. And my grandma just lavished all this attention and love and stuff on me. And I learned how to, that alcoholic manipulation kicked in pretty early for me. There was a point where my parents ended up splitting up. I was sad, but my sisters were happy. I mean, everybody knew that they were better apart. My mom, I never can get through a talk without really describing what my family life was. So like my dad, I told you he likes to smoke weed, but my sisters and I would make fun of him And we would put on, like, we would just imitate him, really. And so we'd say, like, who am I? Who am I? I never want to see you smoking this crap, mijo. And, you know, it was just, it was kind of fun when it wasn't crazy. And my mom is like the Latina Peg Bundy. And I've got these two sisters. One of them is like a size zero. She did really well in school. She was a cheerleader and valedictorian for her class. And Diane, my middle sister, we were really close growing up. She and I kind of vibed more because we really like to drink. But anyway, so she's got tattoos on her neck and big, super long nails. And she kind of, you know, at the time she looked like a Walmart person or like a Jerry Springer guest. And so now I'm the youngest. And that was my family, a ton of family. My mom's the youngest of 9 kids. And once my parents split up, I didn't see my dad for a really long time. I grew up in Northern California. My dad lived in San Jose. We were living in Sunnyvale at the time. And I would go years without seeing my dad. He would occasionally come by at Christmas or some kind of holiday, but he wasn't really too consistent. And my mom, who worked 3 jobs so we could have Christmas, she was really the one to hold the family together. I'm in sixth grade. This is the first drink I ever had. I'm living in Sunnyvale. I've got a girlfriend who lives a couple streets over. She's my best friend, Arena. Her house was always packed. We're hanging out at her house one day, and for whatever reason, nobody was at her house. And so we look in her fridge, and there was absolutely nothing in her fridge except for 2 40 ounces of King Cobra malt liquor. And we were so excited, and we looked at each other like, yes, we're going to drink it. So that's what we did. We had 20 ounces each of this malt liquor. And I don't remember being too put off about how it tasted, but I was really excited for walking down the street. And that change happened for me. I didn't get drunk, but I felt the magic that alcohol had for me. I'll never forget. I'm walking down Ontario Street and the sun is setting. My cheeks are tingling. And for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm going to be okay. What have I been so worried about my whole life? This is great. And we get to my house and my friend Marina starts crying and she's saying that she's depressive. And I'm like, what now? I mean, you know, how old are you in the sixth grade? Maybe like 11. And I was thinking, and I told her, now we're partying. Oh my gosh. Like, this is so not how this was supposed to go. I had expectations about what partying was supposed to be like. And I had no compassion or love for my friend who was struggling. And then my mom came home and we ended up telling my mom that we'd been drinking. It was kind of, we got in trouble, but not too much. And so I could not wait to drink again. That was not the best experience, but I got a taste of what drinking was like, and I couldn't wait to do it again. So the next opportunity I get, I'm in seventh grade, and I've always hung out with older girls. So I'm hanging out with girls from high school while I'm in seventh grade. And there's a girl around the block whose mom is going to go out of town. And she's like, hey, everybody, go out, get booze wherever you can get it. We're going to party at my house. And so we're super excited. And somebody brought over a gallon of vodka. It was Lucky Brand vodka in a plastic, the plastic gallon. And those girls and I mixed that with Kool-Aid and Gatorade. And I don't know what other liquor was there, but we were really out of control. We trashed her house. I ended up peeing on this girl's carpet in her bedroom. I blacked out. That was my second time I drank. And I don't remember walking from her house to my house at the end of the night. And I woke up to an angry phone call the next morning, really early. I was scared because this girl was in high school and now she's threatening to beat me up because of the way we all trashed her house the night before. And my sister, Diane, the one that, you know, looked like a Jerry Springer guest, she sees me on the phone and she's like, who is that? Why are you crying? What's going on? And so she ends up going down to this girl's house and kicking in the door and beating her up. And then the police came and it was just this big drama. And I could not wait to drink again. I was so excited. So I got invited to more parties because everybody's like, oh my gosh, did you hear what happened in Heather's house? Tony's sister is crazy. And I just loved the excitement, even though it was dramatic and crazy. I loved drinking. I loved the excitement behind it all. And I just couldn't wait to do it. So now I'm in high school. I end up going to school. You know, again, we moved so many times. By the time I was a freshman, I had gone to 15 schools. And so now I'm going to high school and I'm really just not showing up. I didn't come from a home where anybody was checking my homework or telling me to put on a sweater. It was really fend for yourself. And so there was really no accountability and I didn't particularly like school. So I was just not a good student. And so my mom, who's always struggled with her weight, she came home one day and she said, you know, my friend at work has lost a lot of weight and she's doing great. She lost 40 pounds. And all she's doing is she's sniffing this powder in the morning and she doesn't eat all day. And just like that, we lost my mom too. And when I say lost her, she was present. She was loving. Don't get me wrong. My mom loved to be in the clubs. Like my mom loves to dance. She likes to party. If I like have a couple of glasses of wine and dance or a Cadillac margarita is my mom's jam. And then she'll dance it off all night. But what happened was she ended up trying methamphetamine and she became somebody we did not recognize almost immediately. And of course, we lost the apartment that we were at and we had been there. That was probably like our longest standing apartment that we had there in Santa Clara. And, you know, it was just sad. And nobody was telling me, Tony, you are homeless. You're homeless now. No, like I could not get the picture. I was 15 years old and I didn't understand. My sisters were older than me. My sister, Diane, she ended up hooking up with a guy from jail. And then she went to go live in a motel room with him. And my sister, Denise, she was out of high school and she was working and she moved in with her boyfriend. And really, there was just no place for me to go. And so I had some pretty good friends at that time. And I just started couch surfing. I started doing the thing where I would tell people that my mom was on drugs and I hadn't talked to my dad in a really long time. Can I spend the night on your couch? And I'll just be here for a little while. And I couch surfed for a little bit. And, I'd love to say that for the people that let me stay with them, that I was good to them, that I contributed something to their family, or that I was of service in some way. And that's not the truth. You know, I was a taker. I didn't know how to be any different. I was really just like a broken little girl, but I was a taker. So now I've dropped out of high school and I'm staying with my dad off and on. I'm trying to drink as often as I can, but now I'm working full time. And there was a period of time where my dad asked me to babysit my little brother. So my dad had another child. I was 15 when Johnny was born. And so they didn't know it at the time, but he was severely autistic. Well, he was autistic and they weren't calling it then. They weren't calling it autism then. They just knew Johnny was really hard to handle. And I was the only one that that could deal with him. And it was supposed to be my junior year in high school. And I was paid to stay home with my little brother because he was really difficult. So I did that for a while until I started working. I was really just wandering. I mean, I wanted to finish out my high school years, but there was seemed to be so much in the way of that. And I was really just in survival mode. And so now my mom, she didn't have anywhere to go. Now she's literally on the streets. I'm partying as often as I can in downtown San Jose. And occasionally I would come across my mom, like on a street corner waiting for a ride. And it was just so sad. My mom was super skinny. And we, like I said, she just became somebody that we didn't know. My mom is from Arizona and she's got a lot of family that was in Santa Clara and San Jose at the time. But as all the tech companies started moving into Northern California, they were really like priced out of homes and rentals. And so everybody at that time, which was like 1998 to 2000, everybody in her family that had homes in Northern California were moving to Arizona for something a little bit more affordable. And so my grandma lived in Arizona and she got sick and the family thought it was going to be the end for her. So my mom gets word that her mom is going to die. And just like that, mom hops on a plane to Arizona, and she never touched a drug again. And we were like, wow, this is really impressive. My sisters and I were just like, this is really amazing. And so my life wasn't really working. I had a boyfriend. I was really emotionally demanding. And life was just not working. I had a car that I crashed. Like my life was unmanageable in every possible way. So I knew that my life wasn't working. I'm drinking every opportunity I get. But I saw that my mom's life got considerably better when she jumped on a plane to Arizona. So I thought, well, maybe I'll get out of here and then I'll go to Arizona. So I did that. And my mom's the youngest of 9 kids. And so I don't know how to be different. I did that geographic, you know, nothing changed except for my zip code. Now I was like couch surfing at all my aunt's house and my cousin's house. And because they're family, they weren't just going to let me get away with anything. So they're saying like, Toni, shouldn't you be in school? What are you doing with yourself? And really the only thing that I wanted to do was party. I love to be at the clubs. I love to dance. I wasn't motivated to do anything else. So my second cousin and I, we would go out to the parties and we would look for ladies' night and all that kind of stuff. Because of course we didn't have any money. We weren't working. And so we go to this club one night and the security guard runs up to me and he said, Toni, there's a miniskirt contest here tonight. You have to be in it because you'll win. If the grand prize is $500. And I thought, dude, I'm in pants. There's no way I'm going to win a miniskirt contest in pants. And he's like, come on, these girls don't know how to dance. So he bought me a couple shots of tequila and I was like, okay, you know what? Maybe I'll give this a shot. So I get up there and I win the miniskirt contest in pants. And this began my career in dancing. So I loved it. I had a great time. I was able to drink. It was perfect for me. So that became my hustle. I started to look up all the Shake That Thing contests and miniskirt contests. And everybody was off my back. They knew I was making money. And that was just, it was a good thing. I had initially a very fun time doing that. And so it was one of these crazy Memorial weekends where I went with some friends to party down in Mexico. And I met him on the beach. And he was unlike anybody that I had seen out there on the beach that day or even in a long time. And I was raised by my grandmother, who both my parents and my grandmother, but my grandmother was devout Catholic. And she really tried to give me some amazing morals. And I did have those morals, but when I'm drinking, I am like the big book says, right? We have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we can't live up to them. And I certainly couldn't when I was drinking. So I end up having a one night stand with this guy. And instead of feeling guilty, I tell myself that that it's different with him, that it's special, and it's got to be God's will that we're together. And so he was from LA. I had never been to LA before. And I had just won another contest. So I had an extra $500 in my purse. And so I tell my friends, hey, let's go partying in LA next week. And they're like, okay, you know, so we're down for another road trip. So we drive to LA, and LA was just amazing. Like, that was such an amazing time for me. It was 2000 and the Lakers were starting to win the championships again. And LA was just like a vibe. Nobody was here telling me, you're drinking, what are you going to do with your life? They were far away. The party was on and nobody was on my back. And I loved the clubs in LA, you know, in Phoenix or in Arizona in general, the clubs close at 1. I cannot, like, that is not, I can't live like that. You cannot, you know, stop serving liquor at 1, you know, that just really didn't work for me. So anyway, I come to LA and, after that 3-day weekend, it's time to go home. And I remember my friends, you know, loading up the car. And I was like, guys, I'm just going to stay here. And they're like, what are you talking about? You don't even know anybody here, you know, aside from that guy. Very early on, I knew it wasn't going to work out with that guy. But I couldn't go back to the questions. I couldn't go back to people asking me about my drinking and what I was going to do with my life. And so I found a little club to work at down the street, and I was 21 years old, and I was living in motel rooms and working at the club. So every day was the same day for me. I would come to in a motel room. I would get a taxi to the club. I would work at the club from like 11 a.m. to about 1 in the morning. And then I would get a taxi, get a bottle, and get another motel room. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard you guys say, we take it one day at a time around here. And I knew how to take it one day at a time, because that's how I lived out there. You know, one drink at a time, one bottle at a time, one taxi at a time, one motel room at a time. And so, you know, at this point, I'm shaking in the morning. I don't really know what that's about, but I tell myself that it's nerves. I tell myself that it's because I'm far away from my family. There was a security guard that worked at that club who lived in Downey, which is, you know, just an outskirt of LA. And he said, you know, I'm leaving my wife and she needs a roommate in Downey. Aren't you tired of living in motel rooms? And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. And so I became roommates with this girl who liked to drink in the morning like me. I was shaking in the morning and I was starting to throw up stomach bile. I didn't know really what that was at the time. I just knew that when I drank, I stopped shaking. When I drank, I felt better. So now I met a guy at the club, and that's a really hard place to, it was very hard to take men seriously in that line of work. But anyway, I was lonely. This guy came into the club. He wasn't like a creepy guy. He didn't get a bunch of dances from a bunch of women. He was really there to be with his friends and to have a couple drinks. And I got to know him better. He wanted a relationship with me. There was not a lot of people that were interested in me at that time. And so I thought, you know what? I'm far away from my family. I really like this guy. I want to make it work. He had a problem with my drinking. And so he told me one time, hey, did you ever think that you drink too much? And I was like, no, everybody drinks at my work. And he's like, well, that's the thing. Like, normal people don't drink when they go to work. And I'm like, well, I mean, I see your lips moving, but that does not make any sense in my head. But I liked him, and I thought he was a good guy. And so I was lonely, and I really wanted to give this relationship a shot. And so I go to work one night, and I knew that I was going to have a date with him after. He was going to have me over his house. And so I walk in the through the doors that day of the bar, and I tell the DJ, hey, just want to let you know I'm not drinking tonight. So if anybody's buying, I'm not drinking. Okay, got it. So I tell the bartender and I tell the waitress, don't serve me tonight. And it was a painfully slow night in the club that night. And nobody came in. I probably had about $3 in my purse when a regular came in, and he's like, shots for everybody. I just got the promotion that I've been waiting for. And so I was like, still, I am not going to drink tonight. I am not drinking. And fast forward a bit, it was a super dead night. And he comes up to me and he says, for every double shot of Patron Tequila you take with me, I'm going to give you $20. And so I say, well, I am here to work, right? I mean, I do have to make money. So $200 later, I am in a taxi going to my boyfriend's house, pretending I'm not drunk. And I don't know about you, but I hate trying to pull this off. Like, you've got the gum and, you know, the body spray, and I'm looking at myself in the mirror and I'm asking the taxi driver, do I look okay to you? Do I look okay? I don't look drunk, do I? And I get to his house and he opens the door and he says, honey, I made you spaghetti. And I'm like, oh God, I do not want to have spaghetti on top of tequila, but I'm in it to win it. Like, I am in this relationship. So I eat the spaghetti, and after he says, hey, let's take some bong rips. And so I say, you know, I want to make it clear I'm not a drug addict, but I am a show off. So I have to show him how good I am at doing this. And as I inhale, I realize the spaghetti is making its way up. And on that exhale, it's all going to come out. And so I get sick. I blacked out. That's the last thing I remember. I came to the next morning on the cold tile floor of his bathroom. And before I could pick myself up, he grabbed me by my ankles and he dragged me from that bathroom into the bedroom where he beat me up. And I watched myself. He had these mirrored closet doors in his room. And I remember watching myself get thrown around this room. And you know, I'm 22 years old. My drinking is a problem. And now I'm getting beat up by this guy. And he ended up kicking me down his apartment stairs. And he said, I just can't handle you. And he threw my little suitcase down at me. And in my suitcase, I have, looking back, it was my alcoholic survival kit, right? It had my my bikinis, my high heels, my makeup. And thank you, God, there was like 2 winches of Jack Daniels and a little bottle there. And so this lady passes by with a shopping cart and asks me in Spanish if she can help me. I ask her if she can please call me a taxi. And I get in the back of that taxi and I take a swig off that, that Jack Daniels. And I'm going to be okay. I'm just beat up. I just can't work for a couple days. I didn't say, wow, I have a problem with my drinking. I just thought that guy is crazy. He was so controlling. So now the shakes are getting so bad in the morning that I can't quiet them down with beer anymore. And it's taking me longer and longer to get enough liquor down without throwing it up to feel better. And so the first time I started shaking so bad, I started convulsing. My roommate took me to the hospital. She took me to Downey Regional, and I'm in Downey Regional, and they treated me. They gave me an IV bag, and they treated me. A couple weeks later, I get this bill in the mail, and it's $900. And then I tell my friend, like, what the hell? They charged me $900. I was only in the ER for a little while. Like, I don't even understand. She's like, Tony, you're so dumb. When you go to the ER, you give them a fake name and a fake social. You never give them your real information. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so brilliant. But it was like perfect for me because I'm a user and a taker. And so I told myself this wasn't going to happen to me again. But because I don't know how to drink, I don't know how to not drink. You know, it happened second, third. The last time I was there, I can honestly tell you, I don't remember if it was my third or fourth time. But this time I had gone under the name Maria de los Santos. And, you know, when I'm drinking, I always think I'm being slick. And the emergency room doctor comes in and he grabs me by my arm and he said, Antonia, if you don't stop drinking, you are going to die of alcoholism. There's not going to be anything pretty left about you. You will die. And there had been a lot of people along the way that had told me I was an alcoholic. You know, I have an aunt who had been in Al-Anon for a long time who saw me coming. When I was 18 years old, she told me I was an alcoholic and I told her she was crazy. So I am trying to make money in the clubs. I am really overweight because in addition to drinking Jack Daniels all day long and drinking beer, I will tear up a carne asada burrito at 3 a.m. at King Taco. So I'm really overweight. I'm not making any money in the clubs and I'm really just making enough money to not be sick. I am so physically addicted to alcohol at 22 years old that I shake and I'm sick if I don't have enough in my system. And so there was a guy, he must've been the last man on earth who wanted anything to do with me, but he was interested in me and he was a friend of my roommate's. He was not my type. My friend said, please go out with him. He's so into you. He's such a good guy. And I'm like, no, he's just really not my type. I'm not into it. But she wore me down. You know, I'm a people pleaser. So I said, fine, I'll go out with him one time. So he takes me to sushi and I just could not wait to get out of there. And of course they don't have liquor at this bar. So I'm annoyed. And he said, well, I really want to take you out on a date tomorrow night. And I said, well, I can't go on a date tomorrow night because I have to make rent. And he's like, well, how much is your rent? And I said, it's $500, my portion. And so just like that, he pulled out my rent money. And I went from dreading being on that date to feeling particularly romantic. I was tired. I was so tired, you know, to think I was 22 years old and I just needed a sucker. I needed someone to take care of me. I just couldn't. And so now I'm with this guy and I went from just barely making it every month to, honey, I became the Paris Hilton of Pico Rivera. Anything that I wanted, I had. All of a sudden, I had the fancy trips. I have, I have the handbags. I have anything I want, any experience that I want, I can have. And so as it turns out, he was a farmer. He grew marijuana. He was really good at it. He would set people up in rental properties and he would pay their rent in exchange for taking their back room or their garage and turning it into a grow room to grow weed. So he had a bunch of crops around town. And if those places ever got busted, the people who were living in the homes had to claim them as their own. So his operation wouldn't be blown. And so, you know, here I am. I grew up poor my whole life. Many times had to stay in motel rooms with the family as a kid. Because honestly, looking back, I can't imagine putting my family through that now. But when I was a kid, it was fun. That was the only shot at vacation that we had. And the unmanageability that I came from was just so great. I remember my mom would send me to McDonald's sometimes, not to buy food, but to get napkins because we didn't even have money for toilet paper. That is where I came from. And now I've got this guy who literally there's like no end to what he can provide. And this was supposed to be it. This was supposed to be happy. This was supposed to be the time that I was happy in life, right? I thought that it was because I was poor that I had that not enoughness in me, that I was not smart, that I couldn't feel or look like the other people around me. This was supposed to fix me. So this is supposed to be a time where my life gets really good. And unfortunately, my drinking is worse than ever. I'm more disconnected than ever. And I am totally aware, whether I have a bottle of Jack Daniels in me or not, that I'm a prostitute, because it's the only way that I could be with this guy that I had nothing in common with, no chemistry with, just absolutely nothing. It was pain, pain, painful. And sadly, this guy loved me. It was really sad. He wanted so desperately to help me and to fix me. And he would say things like, "Tony, I will buy you anything that you want today if you just don't drink." I remember he had family coming in from Australia. And he said, "If you just don't drink, I will give you anything you want." Now, my drinking is no longer working. It is like, it hasn't been fun in a long time, but I cannot not drink. I don't even know how to do that. He finally had the talk with me. He said, "Tony, I can't watch you kill yourself anymore. And it's either the drinking or me." And I looked dead at his face and I said, "Oh my gosh, stop crying. Seriously, I'll just get my stuff and I'll be right out of here. Like, seriously, stop crying. It's kind of a bad look." You know, just like, that was my attitude. I was just so awful. And, you know, that moment was like a really, you know, there were so many surreal moments where like, "Oh my God, is this really happening to me? This is so cringy. Just, I want this to be over. I need a drink right now." And so I couldn't get out of there fast enough, because even though it's causing me problems and my drinking is not working, I don't know how to not drink. You cannot try to separate me from alcohol, because you will lose. And I ended up leaving his place, and I took what was important, right? And what was important was the makeup, the bikinis, and the high heels. And I went right back to doing what I was doing. And a couple days later, I got arrested. I was driving this 65 Chevy El Camino that an ex-boyfriend had given to me that I never paid him for. I'm just really delightful as a girlfriend. I'm pulling out of the club, and there's an Impala that just flies by, and I'm like, "Oh, this guy wants to race, right?" And so I'm driving down Olympic, hauling, and I get the police pull me over. And I remember doing that drunk test outside of the vehicle, and I did it right in front. I was pulled over in front of a toilet junkyard, and I just thought, "Oh my God, this is just the worst." And a motorcycle cop pulled me over, and then another cop came to get me to the holding station. And I got in the back of that cop car and I started crying. And the cop said, "Well, why are you crying?" And I said, "Because the women in jail are going to beat me up." And he's like, "Why would they beat you up?" And I was like, "Because I'm too pretty." And the sad part is, I was just such a hot mess. I was just so, you talk about full flight from reality. There was just nothing attractive about me. I was just so, just trashed. And so I go to jail, and I have nobody else in the world to call except for my ex-boyfriend, the farmer. So I call him and he has somebody come down to bail me out. And I had this moment. I grew up really only going to church and with my grandma because she was really devout, but I never felt a connection there. And then we would go to church, you know, when my dad lost a job or when he went to jail or, you know what I mean? So I kind of like, I never had this connection with the higher power. But on that day, I get the process me and that jail door clangs behind me. And I heard this voice, and I don't even think it was a voice. It was like a feeling that I got deep within me. And it said, "Tony, if you want to drink, it's okay. But get used to coming to places like this." And in that next moment, I thought about my friend Mike. Now, Mike was a guy who lived in the back house of my boyfriend, the farmer's house. And there was a lot of guys that hung out there that really just would do anything to get high or, you know, for a good sack of weed. And so Mike was one of those guys. He kind of became our errand boy. And Mike started talking really crazy one day. You know, we noticed that he wasn't around so much, that every evening he was doing something and he wasn't really around. And so we're like, "What's up, Mike?" And he's like, sobriety is what's up. And we're like, "Oh my God, what happened to Mike? He used to be so cool. Like, what is he doing?" And, you know, a little bit later, he ended up moving out because he wanted to stay sober. And we just thought he was crazy. I was on a really tough hangover on a particular day that he came over for his mail. And Mike walked in. And it was that, I believe I had that same experience that Bill had with Ebby. Mike was fresh skinned and glowing, and I was curious. And I said, "Oh my God, you look so good, Mike. What have you been doing?" And he said, "You know, Tony, all I've been doing, I've been going to a meeting every night. At the end of the meeting, we pray for the alcoholic who still suffers. And that prayer is just long enough for me to say your name." And I am so grateful he didn't try to rescue me, take me to 90 meetings in 90 days, tell me that I need a sponsor, try to tell me that I had a disease. None of it. He was a beautiful example of attraction rather than promotion. So fast forward, now I'm in jail or this holding center and the door shuts behind me. And I remember my friend Mike and that if he could stay sober, maybe I could too. And I don't know why, I just knew it was over on that day. You know, my sobriety date is April 19th, 2002. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a broken 23-year-old little girl. And I got, you know, I got in the middle of a group. Actually, this group kind of just, they circled around me. And I started being sponsored by a woman who was super excited about being sober. And she would, you know, at first it was really difficult. I was still living with my boyfriend, the drug dealer. And it felt uncomfortable to be at a meeting because I was just so used to the chaos. And it got to a point where I was going to a meeting every day. I didn't know the first thing about living. I didn't even know what I liked to drink. I was so broken when I came to you. Do I like lemonade? Do I like water? Do I drink soda? I don't know. I have no idea. All I drink is beer and whiskey. And so I didn't know the fundamentals about living. I would call my sponsor crazy at 2 o'clock and she would say, "Wait a second, did you eat today?" And I would say, "No." She's like, "Did you have coffee?" And I was like, "No." And she's like, "Nope, you need to have physical sobriety. I want you to go to sleep at a reasonable time. I want you to get up in it with enough time to drink some coffee, eat a piece of toast, and go to the noon meeting." And that was my life. You know, for the first 90 days of my sobriety, I was waking up, getting a ride to the noon meeting, and then I would meet her at a meeting at the end of the night. And so I started getting spoon-fed this program. And, you know, the women started to take me under their wing and they would talk to me about wearing more clothes and to how important it is for, you know, Women Alcoholics Anonymous to wear a bra and do these things that were just so foreign to me. And so I started to change. And when I had 90 days sober, the house got raided by the police and the sheriff's department. And at the end of, I'm coming home from a meeting one day and I see the CSI crime lab at the end of my court, right in front of the house. And I was so scared that he was killed because in between crops, he would do in-home invasions on other drug dealers. And I just thought that somebody had found out about one of his robberies and that had something had gone bad. And so, but luckily it wasn't to that extent. He was arrested. And I remember this undercover cop pulling me aside and he said, "Who's Antonia Campuzano?" And I said, "I am." And he said, you know, you're going to jail, right? And I immediately said, can you please, I'm sober 90 days. I have a sponsor. Can you please take me to my sponsor's house or to a recovery home? And I'm one of these people, I have never been given a break. I have cried tears for, for fix-it tickets, for, you know, speeding tickets. And I had never had any grace from the cops. And on that day, this cop said to me, what are you doing with this loser? And had they been to that house 60 or 90 days prior, I would have gone to prison for looking like a drug dealer. I would have looked like a drug dealer's girlfriend, you know? But in those 90 days, Alcoholics Anonymous had changed me in 90 days to not look like a dope dealer's girlfriend anymore. So I went to go live at my sponsor's house because I didn't choose a recovery home because I thought the woman would steal my makeup. And that was, you know, that's all I had. You know, it's been a journey, man. I have loved this journey to a new life. My life doesn't look anything like it used to. And I just love that part in the doctor's opinion where it says we need to be rooted in a power greater than ourselves if we are to recreate our lives. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I ended up staying sober from my first meeting. And there's been a lot of ouchy stuff that has come to pass for me. I ended up meeting a guy on a campus and we got married and we had two boys. And those boys, you know, they're amazing. And that marriage just wasn't working out. And I try to ask for help and I just was met with blame and just kind of, it just wasn't working. And I became really super resentful at 8 years of sobriety. I had a real good, justified resentment. And, looking back, I was really close to a drink, but I ended up filing for divorce. I'm in divorce court. And it's supposed to be the last day we're supposed to end. It's supposed to be the dissolution of marriage. And then he asked the court for me to pay him child support, even though we do 50% custody. And this was like getting punched in the stomach. And the judge granted it. And I remember being so resentful. I'm calling my sponsor from the lobby. And she said, you know what? I don't like it, Tone. But why don't you get yourself a cup of coffee and go to the noon meeting? And I was like, what? Lady, do you hear me? I have real problems. And she's like, yeah, I don't like it either, but you're going to feel better when you go to the meeting. And thank God for the simplicity of this program. You know, I got to that noon meeting and I listened to people share and it gave me enough hope to get to that next 24. And I'm here to tell you, I have a great relationship with him. We are very friendly. We are very versed in tradition one, the common welfare of our family comes first. We put these boys first no matter what. I love being a mom. Like, I always thought I was way too selfish to have kids. And, you know, I have two boys. I have two teenagers that have never seen me drunk. That marriage ended, that first marriage. And then in my home group, many years later, there was a guy who was a real big attraction and we ended up really doing a lot of things right. We got married and that was in 2016 and we were married for 7 years, had so many ups and downs in that time period. He broke his back. My son, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to give my kids this really wonderful life. I love our holidays. I love our family traditions. And I only have those because AA taught me how to have those traditions. And when my son, Leo, my middle son, was nine, he started to get very depressed and he started to talk about suicide. And we got all the help possible. And he was in boys therapy. We were in family therapy, individual therapy, parenting. I mean, you name it. There was not a tool on the table that we weren't taking advantage of. And you know, the therapist said, I want you to take all the knives and all the rope and everything that's dangerous out of the house. And I thought, this can't be my life. Like, I'm a PTA mom. I'm not supposed to, like, my kid isn't supposed to feel like this. And it's been a journey. And Alcoholics Anonymous has held me up the whole way through. And I can tell you, my son is so much better now. We got him help, and we're so much closer. We are so much closer. I have this understanding and love for him. And I know you can't treat mental illness, by being angry or being mean. It takes understanding. It takes compassion. And, you know, it felt for a while that it was taking everything we got, but Leo's in a much better place now. And I'm proud of the way that I show up for my son, the way that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to show up. And, you know, it's kind of funny. We were at a party recently. My oldest son, he was excited to see people, and he was, you know, walking around. And I guess there was a newer guy that had never seen my son, Nico. And he goes up to him. He goes, "Hey, bro, are you new?" My son is 15 and he's very tall. And my son, he goes like, "No way. I've been here my whole life." So it's been so fun to watch my AA kids. And also, you know, in this marriage, my most recent marriage, you know, we were married in 2016. We'd had a really hard time getting pregnant. We had 3 miscarriages. And every single one knocked me down harder than the last. And it was really hard on the whole family. And then, you know, I get pregnant again. And I was just scared at every single day, every single moment. I'm praying that this little baby boy will just stay with me, because I couldn't experience another loss. And he made it, and he's amazing. My son, Rocky, he's 2.5. He'll be 3 in January, and he's autistic. And, you know, it didn't look, you know, like my family life doesn't look the way that it's supposed to. Well, my family life looks a little different than I thought, but I will say, I am so grateful for this program. I sponsor women. I take the steps. I go to a lot of meetings, and I really want to thank you personally. A friend of mine spoke on this podcast, and when I asked about his story, he sent it to me, and I've been listening to this podcast ever since. My life, because I do have a special needs child, there's a lot of therapy. He gets 30 hours of therapy a week, and sometimes I can't be at meetings, as many meetings as I like, but when he's in physical therapy, I can listen to one of these speakers and I can pause if I need to. And I've just had to learn how to adapt. Like, my program looks different, and I have to take my AA program with me. I have to carry my God with me. And, you know, there's been a lot of grief this year too. You know, my dad, I always start out by saying, like, kind of like laughing about my childhood and talking about my dad, and that he was a pothead. But you know, my dad died of alcoholism on May 5th. He died of cirrhosis of the liver. And he looked like he was 100 years old, and he's a young man. My grandmother followed him almost 90 days later, because she was just so brokenhearted. And there's been a lot of tragedy. We've lost 4 women in my home group. 3 to overdoses and 1 to suicide. And, you know, this disease is really alive and well out there. And I love this relationship I have with my higher power. I really think, for me, I don't grow from being on vacation. I don't grow from going camping with my family or being at Disneyland. I grow from the pain. And it's been a lot of pain this last couple of years, and a lot of grief. I've been the kind of woman who, in the past, if I get fired from a job, which it's not common, but if I get let go or I have a breakup, I was taught very early on in my childhood to not be emotional. So I just go through it like a chingona. Like, I think that I'm a badass and that I can handle anything. And that's how I've handled my emotions well into sobriety. So if I have a breakup, that's okay. I'm just going to lose 10 pounds, change my hairstyle, go after a promotion, book a vacation, take the photos, get the likes, get the validation, and no big deal. Like, it never happened. And this grief, especially with my grandma, we were really close. My grandma was like my mom, and my grandma was an Al-Anon. So we shared family recovery. And I got to be there with her at the end of her life. And I was there when her heart stopped. And I was holding her hand and I told her that I was going to continue to make her proud. I was going to continue to stay sober. She was so proud of my sobriety. And I told her that I was going to stay with you guys, that I was going to continue to seek my God, that I was going to continue to sponsor women. And honestly, it is the best thing that's ever happened to me. There's been some really amazing things for me to come to pass. But I'll tell you what, when you take a woman through the steps, when you listen to a fifth step, you watch her make amends and you watch the transformation, this is the best show on earth. This is where I want to be. This is like, I always wanted to feel connected. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much. I depend on this program like the air that I breathe. I take it seriously. And I have a ton of fun here too. I love being sober. It's been the best thing that ever happened to me. But, you know, in that moment with my grandmother at the end of her life, they turned off the machines, they turned off her oxygen, and it was just me holding her hand and just feeling so privileged to have been loved by somebody so deeply in this life. And I've been crying ever since the day that she passed away. And I would have judged myself so much for that in the past. I would push it down and I'm okay. I'm going to be okay. I'm tougher than this. I don't even want to do that this time. I want to honor her life and I want to cry because I want to be different. I'm on this journey to self-acceptance and loving myself in a way that I never have before. I'm excited for what's going to happen next. I'm 44 years old. I'm 21 years sober. And I feel so hopeful for my future because I know if I drink, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to let all these kids down, all my boys. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose everything good and precious to me. But if I stay sober, the sky's the limit, right? Like, it's just going to keep getting better and better as long as I stay close to you guys. I do my best to serve and I keep seeking my God. So I want to thank you so much for having me.
Tony, thank you so much.
Yeah.
So you're named after your grandmother's, one of which you just lost. 3 months before that, you lost your father.
Yeah.
That's a hard year.
It's been a lot of grief, a lot of changes, but, you know, a lot of amazing things too. You know, really being present for my kids, really just praying for God's will for me and the power to carry that out. Like every day is a breadcrumb day. I'm just looking for the breadcrumbs. Okay, God, which direction do you want me to go? Who can I help today? How do you want me to show up?
Which I feel like is exactly where my higher power wants me at all times.
Right? Yeah, but to be surrendered, absolutely.
Well, it's almost like the challenge of becoming a millionaire and remaining humble, right? Like it's the same thing with becoming sober and all having all the promises, but keeping our connection to the higher power and surrendering, even though everything's going smoothly, but things have not been going smoothly with you, but you still have this amazing, I mean, that's such an understatement. It's almost offensive. Things haven't been going smoothly for you. I apologize for the, you know, cheekiness of that. But life has been hard for you is probably more accurate. It's been really, really hard, but you still have this really deep gratitude and serenity about you.
Thank you. I have been having to really get into touch with the joy that's around me at all times. I can't get caught up in, I'm going to be okay when. I'm going to be okay when I get my kids. I'm going to be okay when my autistic son learns how to speak. I'm going to be okay when I get that promotion at work. Like, I can't live there. My higher power wants me to find the joy in my everyday life.
Mike. Tell me about Mike. Does he know that he's your, I think I learned that, is it a penguin? Is he your penguin? Does he know this?
Yes, so he does. And, yeah, you know, he has lost his sobriety a couple times and we're not really in contact. And it's kind of funny, you know, he is one of the guys who he gets up to the podium and people ask him to share. And then they're like, what did he just say? And, you know, and I always defend him, like, cause he ends up saying, all I knew how to do was make pizzas and stay sober. And he gets embarrassed and he goes sits down. And so I always remind people, I don't care what that guy shares. Honestly, when I needed an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, that guy came through. I will be forever grateful. So he's not really good with words, but man, his actions changed my life.
You mentioned being full flight from reality. The person you described in the first half sounds nothing like the person you are today.
Oh my gosh, I was such a mess. I mean, I was lying, manipulating. There was so much self-hate too. There was so much.
You were dealt a really hard hand. I feel like the manipulation was necessary to survive. I feel like that little girl needed it to make it. You know, it's kind of like so many of us needed our first drink to continue on.
Yeah, for sure. I really did. But, you know, I was just, I've always been really hard on myself. So it's not like me to justify, because I do have these morals that, you know, that I grew up with, that my grandma gave me. So I knew the way that I was living was not right. And even when that was the only way to live, I still had a lot of deep shame about that. And then there was so many times where I would call my family in a blackout and then they would never hear from me for weeks, maybe months. And what that did to my family, I can't imagine. I can't even imagine.
Is there anything that you're thinking of now or that you left out of your story that you'd like to share?
Really just that service has really changed my life. I've been taught to say yes in AA when it's convenient and when it's not convenient. There was a moment for me where I always known that service feels good. My sponsor would say, take the actions that make you feel good about being Tony, not to be mistaken with the actions that just make you feel good, right? Because I know going to the spa and getting a massage or a facial is going to make me feel good. But what's going to make me feel good about being Tony is showing up, being of service, saving a seat for a newcomer, grabbing a pamphlet and taking it over to the newcomer. You know, those are the things that make me feel good about being me. I had this experience with a woman. I often say yes to speaking without looking at my calendar or double booking. It's something I'm really trying to work on, time management with my sponsor at 21 years, but it happens. And so I happened to say yes to a speaking gig. I live in Orange County, and the speaking gig was on a Monday night in Los Feliz. And the meeting was at 6 p.m. Now, getting anywhere in Southern California, it can be horrendous Monday through Friday, even on the weekends. But I said yes. And then I realized that I had my kids, my two older teenagers, but they were younger then. I think they were like in fifth and sixth grade. And so I woke up that morning and I said, Tony, just call Los Feliz, just cancel on them. Just tell them you didn't realize that you had your kids. And it's going to be like, just do it and get it out of the way. And all day was like, no, Tony, your feet are trained. You got to show up. But all day, this was taking up so much rent space in my head. You did it again. See, really blew it on your calendar this time. Blah, blah, blah. So just like, but my feet are still moving. And so I go to pick up my kids from their school and they get in, they're preteens. They stink. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And this meeting that we're going to, it's put on by the gays, right? And the gays are impeccable. They have the best snacks. They smell the best. They give the best hugs. I'm like, there is no freaking way I'm taking my dirty kids, my dirty smelly kids, to this gay AA meeting. Hell no. So we have to stop at CVS and I got him these wipes and I got him deodorant. And, you know, we finally, like, you know, we get through getting on the 5 and getting on the 101 and it was hell. And so we finally get there and I'm dreading it. I am dreading it. And these people were amazing to my kids and they took them upstairs and they bought them snacks and they gave them headphones because my kids have never heard my story. My kids do not know. They have no idea who I used to be. And so, you know, they give them headphones and I got through the talk and I just felt so loved up by that group. And I felt so loved the way they loved up my kids. And it was a fun talk. And I left there and I was just like on top of the world. And I was like, you know what, you guys, me and my family were real big Halloween people. So I said, you know what, we're in Los Feliz, we're close. Why don't we go check out the costumes on Hollywood Boulevard? And so the boys are like, yeah. Now it's turned into a late night because we got something to eat and it took a long time at a diner. And now we're walking Hollywood Boulevard and they want to try out all the masks and all the costumes and blah, blah, blah. So now we're walking down the street and from far away, I can see a little boy hauling on his scooter. And I was like, oh my God, this little boy's going to eat it. He's going to hit that little part of the curb and he's going to eat it. So he comes flying down and I'm a boy mom. I know these things. I predicted it. And I caught this little boy in my hands. He was probably about 5. And I look at his face and I said, oh my gosh. And I called him by his name and he looked up at me and he goes, you know me? And I said, I actually know your mom. And I looked up and the next person that I saw was his mom that I knew from meetings. And she was also on a scooter and she was at least 40 pounds lighter than the last time I saw her. Her face was picked over and she looked like a crazy person. And she looked at me like she saw a ghost. She said, Tony, did you talk to my sister today? And I was like, no, I don't even know your sister. And she's like, I talked to my sister today. She told me that I needed to go to rehab. But if I didn't go to rehab, could I please call that nice lady Tony from the meetings? And I was shook. I never go to Hollywood. I've never been to Hollywood on a Monday night. I showed up to something that I did not want to show up to. I guess that night I needed to see what happens to moms who don't go to meetings. And that woman needed to see an example of a sober mom out there on that street that day. You know, I had a lot of mom guilt for a long time. I've got these kids and I have to go to meetings. I always have to leave them and I can't, you know, I can't do this. I can't be the Betty Crocker mom. I can't do that because I had like this guilt about leaving them. And it's those moments that I know without a doubt that sometimes AA can be an inconvenience, but the inconvenience it would be to my family to have a drunk mom or for them to have to bury me would be way worse. So I keep showing up to my commitments and I keep doing the best that I can. And because I do that, I get to present like this mom and I get to be in my company. Being of service to AA has taught me how to be of service at work. And my work thinks that I'm amazing. I'm non-degreed. I work with people who have their bachelor's and their master's, and they have no clue. You know, all I have is my little AA, you know, my Alcoholics Anonymous Love and Service degree. That's what qualifies me for my job. And it's amazing. This life, I can't even. It's just, I love my life.
You started your share with how much you love being of service, and you concluded it with how much you love being of service with such an amazing, unforgettable story. And you're a really good storyteller. So I was just over here really enjoying myself.
Thank you.
I may end it right there, but I may not. I have a final question that I ask, but you set it up for such a beautiful ending. My final question is for the alcoholic out there or addict suffering, what final message would you like to leave with them?
I tried to stay sober so many times by myself. Like April 19th, 2002 was a day that a grace and willingness came into my life at the same time. And that can't be manufactured by one person. I really think that has got to do with the individual surrendering and like God swooping in at the perfect time. The only thing that I can say is go to a lot of meetings. Go to a lot of meetings.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.